Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to do chapter 20 of Genesis, verses 1 through 18, the entire chapter. I'm going to call this section of scripture Sarah in Abimelech's harem in Gerar. Our previous chapter, the context is this. In Genesis 19, God has destroyed Sodom. Abraham watched the destruction from Hebron, and then he decides to leave, we assume shortly thereafter. So we start in verse 1, Genesis 20. Now Abraham journeyed from there toward the land of the Negev and settled between Kadesh and Shur. Then he sojourned in Gerar. Now we're going to have to start out this lesson with a lot of geography, and the geography is not that easy, so I'm going to try to do the best I can to describe the situation on several maps that I have. First of all, Kadesh, that's Kadesh Barnea. That's the famous place that the Israelites stopped at before they went into the land of Israel. It was at the southern tip of the Dead Sea towards the west. It was right before you got to the Wadi El Arish, the Brook of Egypt, that separated Egypt from Israel. And if you look at the Mediterranean Sea to the north, it's right when the Mediterranean Sea starts running instead of from west to east, but from south to north. It's right north of the wilderness of Sin. If you look at the Sinai Peninsula, right north, the Sinai Peninsula is formed by the two gulfs of the Red Sea, the Gulf of Suez to the west and the Gulf of Aqaba to the east. The Sinai Peninsula is between those two gulfs. And then if you go right north of the Sinai Peninsula, it's the wilderness of Paran, which is in no man's land, really, between the Gulf of Aqaba and the southern tip of the Dead Sea. You go north of that, you get to the wilderness of Sin. And the northern part of the wilderness of Sin is where Kadesh Barnea is, as I said, at the southern end of the Dead Sea, except toward the west a little bit. Kadesh Barnea is real close to probably where Beer Lahai-Roi is, where Hagar met the angel of the Lord, telling Hagar that, hey, you're safe, your son is going to have an inheritance. Also, now, if you use the Dead Sea as a marker to get oriented, if you go further north, roughly further north, the bottom third of the Dead Sea is Beersheba. If you go further north from there, at the bottom of the top third of the Dead Sea is Hebron. And if you go further north, at the very top, the very northern edge of the Dead Sea is Jerusalem. That's kind of how I keep myself oriented. All right, so if we go from Kadesh Barnea to Beersheba, which is to the north and also a little bit toward the west, that's Beersheba. Now, between Beersheba, if you go northeast of Beersheba, go toward the Mediterranean Ocean, is the southern town of Gaza, which several hundred years later was a Philistine city. So Gaza's on the coast. You go from Beersheba to Gaza. Right in between there is the land of Gerar, and that's where Abraham is headed. That's where he ended up settling after he left Hebron. So that's a little bit complicated, but if you look at the maps, you can see where Abraham was. He basically was south of Gaza. That's the best way, because Gaza's still there even today, down there to the south of Israel. Now, when it says the land of the Negev just means the southern desert part of Israel. So he left Hebron and headed south. So he settled before he got to Gerar, the story's going to take place in Gerar, but before he got to Gerar, he settled between Kadesh and Shur. So that's further south. Kadesh Barnea is further south. And Shur is the desert as you go toward Egypt, toward the west. That's the desert that connects Egypt and Israel. He stayed there for a while, and then he went back up north past Beersheba, go north toward Gaza. And before he got to Gaza, he stopped at Gerar. So this is two different places he was at. Now, Kadesh Barnea that I mentioned is something that we ought to take some time and look at, because it's a very famous place. It means holy. It's a sacred desert of wandering, the name indicates. This is from Easton's Illustrated Dictionary. It's a place on the southeastern border of Palestine, about 165 miles from Horeb, from Sinai. It was in the northern part of the desert of Sin, as I just said. It was on the border of Eden. Now, why is it famous? Because it was from this place, in compliance with the desires of the people, Moses sent forth 12 spies to spy out the land. After examining it in all districts, the spies brought back an evil report, Joshua and Caleb alone giving a good report. Influenced by the discouraging report, the people abandoned all hope of entering into the promised land. So that's the northernmost point of their sojourning before they went into the wilderness. Because of their unbelief, they were condemned by God to wander for 38 years in the wilderness. Some people say, and one theory is, they wandered 38 years right there around Kadesh Barnea, although it's not clear. At the end of the 38 years, the tribes were a second time gathered together at Kadesh Barnea. During their stay here at this time, Miriam died and was buried. So Miriam, the famous Miriam, Moses' sister, was buried at this place. Here the people murmured for want of water, as their forefathers had done formerly at Rephidim. In other words, before the 38 years of wandering, as soon as they left Egypt, they complained about lack of water. Moses struck the right. Now it happened again here at Kadesh Barnea, near there. With his rod, he smote the rock twice. Because of that, Moses and Aaron were not allowed to enter the promised land, and so forth. As they were there at Kadesh Barnea, the king of Edom, which was just north of them, would not let them pass through his territory, and so they had to go east and go around the eastern side of the Dead Sea. So that's Kadesh Barnea. And then as you go due west toward Egypt, you enter the desert of Shur. Shur means an enclosure, a wall, probably of the Arabian Desert on the northeastern border of Egypt, given its name to a wilderness extending from Egypt toward Philistia, which is near Gaza in the on the south of Israel on the Mediterranean coast. Now Gerar, where Abraham went to after he left that place between Kadesh Barnea and Shur, he left that place and he went to Gerar. This is what Easton says about Gerar. Abraham sojourned there, and perhaps Isaac was born in this place. And perhaps, actually, Sarah might have been pregnant with Isaac as they went toward Gerar. This is when Abraham is 100 and Sarah is 90 years old. Both of these patriarchs were guilty of the sin here, denying their wives. Both of them entered into a treaty with the king before they left for Beersheba, which is a little bit to the south and east of Gerar, which is later. Now, Gerar, Abimelech of Gerar, appears to have been a righteous man. The Gerarites are termed a righteous nation, as Adam Clark says. We read in Genesis 20, verse 4. Now, Abimelech had not come near her, near Sarah, and he said, "Lord, will you slay a nation, even though blameless?" So the nation is blameless. Well, he might have been talking about his innocence in the case of Sarah, not innocence in general. So I don't think that's a very strong argument that Clark gives. The term Gerar means circle or region. The place has not been fully identified, but the site is probably in one of the branches of the Wadi Sharia at a place called Gerar, near the coast southwest of Gaza and 9 miles from it. So that's the best way to locate Gerar in your mind. Think of where Gaza is because it's still there today. You can go 9 miles to the southwest. There's a question mark on the BibleAtlas.org map, so they don't know for sure, but most probably. Now, there's something here. There's a little anachronism here because at some place here, which we'll get to later, I'm not sure it's in this chapter, but later on, the statements in Genesis indicate that Gerar belonged to the Philistines. And we are led to infer that Abimelech was king of that people, but it is quite certain that they, the Philistines, did not occupy this region until after the time of Abraham, several hundred years later, and in fact only a short time before the Exodus, about 400 years later. It is probable, however, that the writer of Genesis, that would be Moses, would refer to the country as it was known in his day. An anachronistic reference, just like if I was I'm so used to reading ancient history that if I was telling somebody about Western Turkey, I wouldn't call it Western Turkey. I'd call it Ionia. Well, if you knew ancient history, you would know what Ionia is, even though it's no longer called Ionia. So that's not really a problem. Now, Abraham left for this place between Kadesh Barnea and Shur, having lived in Mamre, the Oaks of Mamre near Hebron, for about 15 or 20 years. Remember, that's where he looked down and saw Sodom burning up. Question is why did he leave Hebron? Well, here's some options for why Abraham moved from Hebron. John Gill says maybe he could not bear the stench of the sulfurous lake down there, the Dead Sea, where Sodom and Gomorrah had been destroyed. Gill says this is unlikely because of the distance. I think he's right. It could have been he wanted to avoid the scandal of Lot's incestuous daughters. Remember from the previous chapter how the older and younger daughter of Lot got him drunk and had sex with him, and they had Moab and Ben-Ami, the ancestors of Moab and Ammon, and that was pretty scandalous. There's incest, and so maybe Abraham wanted to avoid that scandal. Well, Gill says that's unlikely because of the distance from Hebron and the cities of the plain down there in the south of the Dead Sea. My speculation is maybe Abraham just needed better pasture for his herds. Aren't nomads constantly wandering around looking for more pasture land? Jameson Fawcett Brown said, in the neighborhood of Gerar was a very rich and well-watered pasture land. Adam Clark has a speculation. Maybe Abraham couldn't bear the sight of the ruined cities of the plain. It would remind him that his nephew Lot was missing and presumed dead. Abraham doesn't know what happened to Lot yet. Lot's still up in the cave in the mountains around Sodom. But at any rate, wherever he left, Abraham has now become a sojourner in a strange land. Remember, all Canaan was possessed by pagans at this time. Abraham was the only righteous man wandering around. We go to verse 2. and 3 of Genesis 20. Abraham said of Sarah his wife, "She is my sister." So Abimelech, king of Gerar, went and took Sarah. But God came to Abimelech in a dream of the night and said to him, "Behold, you are a dead man because of the woman whom you have taken, for she is married." They took marriage seriously back then, unlike today. Now, of course, you recognize this story. Abraham did the same thing in Gerar that he did in Egypt about 25 years earlier. Now, if he did wrong in Egypt, one would have think he'd learned his lesson, but he didn't. This was standard operating procedure. He had agreed with Sarah before he even left Haran or left Ur that we're going to do this deal. You're going to be my sister, not my wife. Now, some people speculated maybe when he left Egypt with so much wealth that the Pharaoh had given him, maybe it had gone to his head and he said, I can just do this again. I'm not going to worry about risking all my wealth by protecting my wife. And of course, that makes Abraham look very, very bad. Abraham perhaps could say, well, God didn't punish me in Egypt. Why is he going to punish me here in Gerar? Well, we'll talk about that in a minute. I'm going to try to justify Abraham a little bit, give him a defense, even though it's a difficult case, because most all of the commentators said he was a real cad for doing what he did. First of all, let's see if we can defend him by saying, well, he told the truth. She was his sister, half-sister at least. John Gill says, and I think correctly, that this was really an unjustifiable lie, or at least a deception. I mean, if you deceive somebody by telling them a half-truth, it's still a lie. So we're not going to defend Abraham that way. We're going to defend him by saying, well, it was a lie, but it was in self-defense. It's like saying, I'm defending Jewish prisoners in my basement. The Nazi soldiers come to the door and I say, there's nobody here. Well, that's lying to save people's lives. We're not going to get too upset about that. At least I'm not. I am. Some Christians will, but I'm not. Now, John Gill says by lying like this, he's exposed his wife to losing her chastity. We're going to look at that in just a minute. He also says, Abraham showed distrust in divine providence. Well, I don't know. I could argue that it shows trust in divine providence. He could say, well, you go into the harem, Sarah, but God providentially got you out of the Pharaoh's harem 25 years earlier. He's going to get you out of Abimelech's harem too, which would be exactly the opposite of showing distrust. Now, I gave a defense of Abraham's actions concerning Sarah when he was in Egypt in Genesis 12, and I'm not going to go over those again. But I must say that it's harder to defend Abraham here in Gerar, because when he was in Egypt, he went there because of a famine in Canaan, and he had no option. He couldn't go back. And if he had told the truth to the Pharaoh that Sarah was his wife, then Sarah was a lot younger, a lot more beautiful probably, and the Pharaoh is more likely to take her into the harem. So he was more justified there, I think, in what he did. And my defense was basically this, is that he put her into the harem knowing that it takes a long time for somebody in the harem to have sex with a king, at least a year. And he was thinking maybe that'd buy him some time to get him out, so he could get her out somehow. And he really had no other choice. He couldn't go back to the famine. And if he'd have told the truth, he had no police force. He had no army. He had no military. He had no consulate he could run to. He was just down there naked. And somebody would have gotten him and killed him and taken Sarah. So he made the best of a bad situation. That's basically my defense of Abraham in Egypt. But now here in Gerar, there is no famine that made him go there. He could have gone somewhere else. And Sarah is now 90 years old, not 65 years old as in Egypt, but 90 years old. She's a lot older. So maybe it would have been more understandable if Abraham had just told the truth and said, she's my wife, figuring that Abimelech's not going to do anything with a 90-year-old woman to put her in the harem. Well, in defense of Abraham, let's look at his options now here in Gerar. First of all, he could have told Abimelech the truth, and that would have risked someone stealing his wife and killing him, assuming she was still very beautiful at 90. Oh, which is, 90 is not like 90 years today. It was a lot different back then. If she lived to be, say, Abraham lived 125, I don't know how long Sarah lived. Let's say she lived that long too. 90 out of 125, that's about 3/4 of her life. So if you say, let's say a woman today is 90, is 75, lives to 75, a quarter of her life would be 25. That would be about 50 years of her life. Well, women 50 years old can look pretty hot, so maybe she was still okay looking. And so Abraham was still nervous about someone stealing his wife because of her beauty. Well, he could have told Abimelech the truth and risk getting killed and losing his wife. So he has option number two. He could go somewhere else. Well, he probably would have run into the same problem no matter where he went. Whenever there was pasture land, there would be political leaders with power, and they might be tempted to take his wife, who is perhaps beautiful. Or he could lie or tell a half-truth, which is the same as a lie to Abimelech, and that's what he did. Now, he might have hoped that Abimelech might not have taken Sarah. He says, well, she's my half-sister, and he says, okay, well, that'll keep people from killing me in order to get my wife. They might come after her as a suitor, but not as a murderer. But as it turns out, the king of Gerar took Sarah against his guess and against Abraham's hope. And so, in other words, Abraham took a chance by saying that Sarah was his sister. He took a chance that nobody would get her, and he guessed wrong. Well, hindsight's 20/20. He did the best he could. He took a chance, and he was wrong, and so Sarah ends up in Abimelech's harem. Now, Abraham knew that women in harems didn't have sex with the king for a long time because it took so long to train the women and so forth. That's just typical of harems at the time. Abraham would know that. It could be that since Sarah was 90, Abraham figured Abimelech didn't want her for sex, just for an alliance, a marriage alliance. And so, therefore, Abimelech's not going to have sex with her. He just wants a political marriage. And Abraham had seen God deliver Sarah from the Pharaoh before. Why not Abimelech, too? Why cannot God not deliver Sarah from Abimelech just like he delivered her from Pharaoh? And we also know that Abraham was never rebuked by God for what he did. That's not really a slam dunk argument, but it is worthy of note. Well, I did my best to defend old Abraham. None of the commentators do. They all think he was a cad for what he did. I'll let you decide. Isaac pulled the same stunt in Gerar later on, incidentally, in Genesis 26, verse 7, which we'll get to in a few chapters. When the men of the place asked about Isaac's wife, he said, "She is my sister," for he was afraid to say, "My wife," thinking the men of this place might kill me on account of Rebekah, for she is beautiful, like father, like son. Apparently, these people in the desert countries love to steal people's wives. Now, let's go back to the issue of whether Sarah is still beautiful enough to attract the eye of kings, even though she was 90 at the time. Adam Clark says, nope, her beauty had been considerably impaired by then. Abimelech took her not for her beauty, but rather to make an alliance with Abraham, because Abraham was a very rich man. Remember, Abraham's flocks had squeezed out Lot's flocks in Hebron, and before that, Pharaoh of Egypt had sent Abraham out of the country with a ton of camels, donkeys, sheep, oxen, male and female servants. So Abraham was rich. And so Clark is saying, and I think reasonably, that Abimelech is looking for an alliance with Abraham. He's not looking to have sex with this sister. And Adam Clark even goes further and says maybe Sarah was pregnant with Isaac at the time, in which case there was even less reason to put Sarah in the harem, of course. But if she was pregnant and noticeably pregnant, obviously Abimelech's going to think, well, what's going on here? Your sister's pregnant. How did that happen, Abraham? That would have tipped everybody off, and she certainly wouldn't have ended up in the harem. So I don't think that's really an issue either way. I think that's a speculation that doesn't ring true to me. But at any rate, whether Sarah was beautiful or not, she ended up in Abimelech's harem. Now, Abimelech is probably the first king of Gerar to have that name. Afterwards, all the kings of Gerar had that name, Abimelech, so it's sort of like a title rather than a name. Now, when God came to Abimelech, Adam Clark says, quote, "Thus we find that persons who were not of the family of Abraham had the knowledge of the true God." So God could come to a vision to whoever he wanted to, even pagans. God told Abimelech, "You are a dead man." God thus effectively protected Sarah's chastity. What would have happened if God had not intervened there to protect Sarah's chastity? Well, when Sarah became pregnant with Isaac by Abraham, people would say, nah, that's not Abraham's son, that's Abimelech's son. And then the question of the legitimacy of the promised seed of the covenant would be questioned. Did the seed come from Abraham as God promised in Genesis 15, Genesis 12, and Genesis 15, Genesis 17? Or did it come from Abimelech? In other words, is the promised seed a bastard? So yeah, it was very necessary for God to protect Sarah's legitimacy here, or Isaac's legitimacy and Sarah's chastity. Very necessary. Note how strong the language is. God says, "You are a dead man, Abimelech." This is my speculation. It's probably necessary to use strong language with a king. Kings are not used to being told something that strongly, and God told it to him. He says, I don't care if you are a king, you better let this woman out of your harem. Genesis 20, verses 4 and 5. Now Abimelech had not come near her, in other words, to have sex with her, and he said, "Lord, will you slay a nation, even though blameless? Did he not himself say to me, 'She is my sister,' and she herself said, 'He is my brother'?" So Sarah participated in this deception. "In the integrity of my heart and the innocence of my hands, I have done this." And Abimelech was entirely correct. He's saying, "God, you going to punish me? I didn't do anything wrong." He said, "Slay a nation, not just me, but a nation," which could mean his family or his kingdom. John Gill makes the interesting point. Maybe Abimelech has the recent destruction of Sodom in his mind. Everybody would know that Sodom was destroyed. The story would have gotten out. It was the God of Abraham that did that. And maybe you better not mess around with Abraham. So, and especially when you have a dream from Abraham's God, maybe you better not mess around with Abraham. Look what happened to Sodom. So Abimelech continued to justify himself before God, said, look, it was not only Abraham that told me this lie. Sarah did too. She didn't object when Abraham said she was his sister, and then she herself said affirmatively, he is my brother. Now, I ask a question here. When Abraham's pulling this stunt, Sarah obviously went along with it. Should she have objected? Well, we'll see later on they had made a deal when they had gotten married, or at least when they had left Haran, they had made a deal that Sarah was to participate in this lie every time Abraham thought it up. So that's probably why she didn't object. We go to verses 6 and 7 of Genesis 20. Then God said to him in the dream, said to Abimelech, yes, I know that in the integrity of your heart you have done this, and I also kept you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. Touch her means to have sex with her. Now, therefore, restore the man's wife, for he is a prophet, and he will pray for you, and you will live. But if you do not restore her, know that you shall surely die, you and all who are yours. Now, Abraham is called a prophet here. As Gill and the NIV Study Bible say, Abraham was the first man in the Bible to be called a prophet. Now, why was Abraham called a prophet? Here's what John Gill says, quote, he was, quote, familiar with God, dear unto him, a friend of his, to whom he communicates his secrets, is able to foretell things to come, as well as to interpret the mind of God and instruct in the knowledge of divine things. Well, prophet is, we think of prophet as someone who foretells. I'm going to read you a good quote here from Adam Clark that shows that a prophet was more than just a foreteller of the future. It rather means one who intercedes and prays. So Abraham was called a prophet not because he was a predictor of the future, it's because he intercedes and prays for people like he prayed for Abimelech. Now, of course, we generally take the word as someone who foretells the future, and so we have a problem when we hear the word in English. It doesn't ring with us the way it did with the people in the hearing it in their native language. Let me read the quotation from Clark. Quote, the word prophet, which we have from the Greek prophetes, and which is compounded of pro, before, and phemi, I speak, means in its general acceptation one who speaks of things before they happen, i.e. one who foretells future events. But that this was not the original notion of the word, its use in this place sufficiently proves. Abraham certainly was not a prophet in the present general acceptation of the term, and for the Hebrew nabi, we must seek some other meaning. I have, in a discourse entitled The Christian Prophet and His Work, proved that the proper ideal meaning of the original word is to pray, entreat, make supplication, etc. And the meaning of it I have justified at large, both from its application in this place and from its pointed use in the case of Saul, mentioned in 1 Samuel 10, and the case of the priest of Baal, 1 Kings 18, where prophesying most undoubtedly means making prayer and supplication. As those who were in habits of intimacy with God by prayer and faith were found the most proper persons to communicate his mind to man, both with respect to the present and the future, hence Nabi, the intercessor, became in process of time the public instructor or preacher, and also the predictor of future events, because to such faithful praying men, God revealed the secret of his will. So basically, Clark is saying that Abraham is a prayer, an intercessor. Later on, the word changed in its meaning and came to mean a preacher. And then later on, it came to mean a prophet. Well, whatever he was a nabi, a prophet, and he prayed for Abimelech. Genesis 20, verses 8, 9, and 10. So Abimelech arose early in the morning and called all his servants and told all these things in their hearing, and the men were greatly frightened. Then Abimelech called Abraham and said to him, what have you done to us? And now have I sinned against you, that you have brought on me and on my kingdom a great sin? You have done to me things that ought not to be done. And Abimelech said to Abraham, what have you encountered that you have done this thing? Now the men of Abimelech's kingdom, the men of Gerar, were frightened. And John Gill says the reason they were frightened is probably because they had the recent destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah in their heads. Now when Abimelech says, what have you done to us? There's some options as to what Abimelech's tone of voice was. Was he passionate and angry? That's the way it sounds to me. But John Gill says that he was calm and reasonable. And Adam Clark says he was respectful and pious. What have you done to us? In other words, he's very careful because he didn't want Abraham to smash him. He didn't want Abraham's God to level him like Yahweh had done to Sodom and Gomorrah. So that goes either way. I'm not sure. It sounds like he's angry to me. But all three of my commentators disagree with me. Gill says he was calm and reasonable. Clark says he was respectful and pious. And Jameson, Fox, and Brown say this, quote, "What a dignified attitude is that of the king, calmly and justly reproving the sin of the patriarch, but respecting his person and heaping coals of fire on his head by the liberal presents made to him." All right, well, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe all three commentators are right. I don't know, but it sounds to me like he's ticked off Abimelech is. And I find it hard to disagree with him. I know I gave a defense of Abraham before, but it's a rough defense. It's like defending O.J. Simpson. You know, his lawyers got him off in a very difficult factual situation that nobody in the country believes. And maybe you could get Abraham off that way. But Adam Clark says Abraham's conduct was far from defensible. Well, I gave Abraham a defense. So it's not, I think Clark is being extreme there when he says Abraham is far from defensible. Yeah, you could defend Abraham. I just did it. I don't know how good my defense is, but at least there's a defense, a reasonable defense. You could say that it's pretty amazing that the patriarch of the whole redeemed human race would do something like this, especially since he had done the same thing earlier. Jameson, Foss, and Brown says, quote, "What a sad thing when men of the world show a higher sense of honor and a greater abhorrence of crimes than a true worshiper." He goes on to say, quote, "Abraham's life would have been as well protected without the fraud as with it. And what shame to himself, what distrust to God, what dishonor to religion might have been prevented." So you see, most people think Abraham was a real cad for what he had done. I'm not so sure. I keep thinking, well, okay, Gil, what would you have done in that situation? Told the truth and gotten Sarah killed and killed the promised line of the Messiah, you know? I think we need, if we think Abraham did wrong, I think we ought to at least consider what a terrible situation he was in. Now, Abimelech said to Abraham, "What have you encountered that you have done this thing?" Which is a little strange translation. The NIV has, "What was your reason for doing this? Why did you do this?" Genesis 20, verses 11 through 13, Abraham answers. Abraham said, "Because I thought, surely there is no fear of God in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife. Besides, she actually is my sister, the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother, and she became my wife. And it came about when God caused me to wander from my father's house that I said to her, 'This is the kindness which you will show to me. Everywhere we go, say of me, he is my brother.'" Well, let's look at Abraham's defense of himself here. First of all, he says, surely there's no fear of God in Gerar, and people are going to kill me. Well, I would think that the place was probably just as godless as he has anticipated, because remember, Abraham is living amongst pagans everywhere, Canaanites. Why wouldn't the people of Gerar be as godless as they were everywhere else? Adam Clark says, on the other hand, that it was bigoted for Abraham to think that. Bigoted. He's prejudiced against Gerar. There actually was a fear of God in Gerar, Clark says. Really? And where was that? I don't know how he says that. And then another thing, and go into another point of Abraham's defense, besides she actually is my sister, I've already said, I don't think that flies. It's telling a half-truth to deceive, the technical defense of the truth. And of course, well, in agreement with what I just said, the NIV Study Bible says that the half-truth about sister being his sister was a, quote, sinful deception. I agree with that. The NIV Study Bible says it is, quote, not a legitimate explanation. I agree with that. I don't think that's the way to defend yourself, Abraham. You could have done better than that. But the defense that he might have gotten killed and his wife taken from him, I think is probably a decent defense. Now, how is Sarah Abraham's half-sister? Because I've already said this, Terah, his father, had Abraham by one mother and then had Sarah by another. Excuse me. Terah had Abraham by one wife and then had Sarah by another wife. And that was legal back then to marry such half-brothers and half-sisters. It was not legal if you had one mother and two different fathers, and that mother had one kid. Later on, she had a kid by another husband, and those two half-brothers, they were not allowed to marry each other, and I don't know why that is, but it's the feeling is that's too close to get married. I don't know why. It's something about having the same mother makes the relationship of the kids closer than if you have half-brother and half-sister by different mothers. But at any rate, we now know that Sarah was Abraham's half-sister. And in verse 13, it came about when God caused me to wander from my father's house. That's either from Haran in Syria or in Babylonia, in Chaldea. At some point, when Abraham left, he made a deal with Sarah. He says, this is what you're going to do for me. We get married. You say that he is my brother. And Sarah went along with that. So that was the deal they had. So that's another thing in Abraham's favor. Sarah was not being sacrificed against her will. She willingly entered into such a deal. Now, the time frame here, I've already mentioned this in passing, but the time frame is this. Abraham left Ur about 25 years before this when he was 75, and now He's about 100 years old when Isaac is about to be born or has been born, is coming close to being born. What Abraham was trying to show here is that this scheme of his to say Sarah was his brother was concocted at least 25 years ago. It was a long time ago in the making. It was not dreamed up recently in order to snooker Abimelech. So Abraham, from the very get-go, must have realized that Sarah's beauty would have really made him vulnerable as he wanders around in the land of the Canaanites. We go to Genesis 20, verses 14 through 16. Abimelech then took sheep and oxen and male and female servants and gave them to Abraham and restored his wife Sarah to him. Abimelech said, "Behold, my land is before you. Settle wherever you please." To Sarah he said, "Behold, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. Behold, it is your vindication before all who are with you, and before all men you are cleared." So Sarah's honor and chastity are preserved. Now it appears that the pagan Abimelech acted much more honorably than Abraham the believer. That's if you assume that Abraham didn't do the right thing here. And again, it's questionable that he did do the right thing by lying to Abimelech. Extremely questionable, despite the defense I gave him. The NIV says that Abimelech gives, quote, "a strong contrast to Abraham's fearlessness and deception." Fearfulness. Abimelech gave a strong contrast to Abraham's fearfulness and deception. Now, Abimelech wanted Abraham to intercede for him because he had learned God had told Abimelech in the dream that Abraham was a prophet, and if prophet Nabi back then meant someone who intercedes for, he says, okay, if he's a prophet, if he's an intercessor, I want him to intercede for me. This is a pagan now. And again, this is Abraham representing the God who just destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Now, Abimelech's attitude was even better than Pharaoh when Pharaoh found out that Sarah was Abraham's wife. Pharaoh kicked Abraham out of Egypt. Now, Pharaoh did give him a lot of wealth on the way out, but he did kick him out. But Gerar said, hey, you can settle here. No problem. Now, verse 16 says this. To Sarah, he, Abimelech, said, "Behold, I've given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. Behold, it is your vindication." The King James has, "It is your reproof." Sarah is reproved rather than vindicated. Well, it turns out the Hebrew there is very hard to translate. Here's what Clark says about this verse 16. But what did he say? Here there is scarcely any agreement among interpreters. The Hebrew is exceedingly obscure, and every interpreter takes it in his own sense. So we'll leave that one open. Either Sarah was reproved or she was vindicated. I suspect she was vindicated. I don't think Abimelech's in the mood for reproving Sarah right now. He's trying to be nice. He's giving a bunch of money away. He said, you can come settle here. But now I'm going to reprove you, Sarah, for what you did to me. I don't think so. I think he vindicated her, saying your chastity is intact. We go now to verses 17 and 18 of Genesis 20. Abraham prayed to God. Remember, Abimelech asked Abraham to pray for him, and Abraham did so. Abraham prayed to God, and God healed Abimelech and his wife and his maids, so that they bore children. For the Lord had closed fast all the wombs of the household of Abimelech because of Sarah, Abraham's wife. In other words, because Sarah was in that harem, all the women of the kingdom could not have children, and it is thought that some disease had kept the wives from cohabiting with their husbands and so forth, therefore they couldn't get pregnant. John Gill even speculates it was with large tumors. Cystic fibroid tumors, maybe? I never heard of that stopping husbands from having sex with their wives. Maybe it's some kind of tumor. That's really a wild speculation. But it's a reasonable speculation to think that some disease had come so that the women couldn't have sex, so they couldn't have children. And in fact, that same disease could have kept Abimelech away from Sarah, thus preserving her chastity. But I think more likely is it just takes so long for women in a harem to have sex with a king. At any rate, whoever was at fault, God sovereignly worked it out so that Sarah, the mother of all nations, the mother of the promised seed, the mother of those who were the immediate ancestors of Jesus Christ, the Messiah. She was pure. She was protected by God. God is providential. He is in charge of history. He takes care of things. Ladies and gentlemen, with that happy note, we have finished Genesis chapter 20. In our next audio, we will take up Genesis chapter 21, verses 1 through 7, the birth of Isaac, as we see that the promise of a seed to Abraham is commenced. And so we will take that up in our next audio. I hope you enjoyed this one.